Dr. Tom Crowett is an American botanist and considered one of botanical history's most prolific plant collectors. Tom has worked with the Missouri Botanical Gardens for more than 50 years. His life passion is tropical plants, in particular the Araceae family, known as aroids. Thanks to Tom, the Missouri Botanical Gardens has the largest living collection of aroids in the world. Tom, when I listened to you speak on Sunday recently at the local Aroid Society meeting in Gingin, you shared some amazing adventures and misadventures. What has been the most poignant and memorable stories that you could share with us? There's so many, I know.
Yeah, I could write a book about stories. Yeah. But I suppose the story I related about when I was collecting in Costa Rica with my family, we were living in Panama, and we made a trip to Costa Rica with my truck. I had built this camper, a special camper on the truck, which enables me to dry plants on a continuous basis.
Yeah.
I built it in my garage in St. Louis, and it's powered by the 100-pound propane cylinder and enables me to dry the plants on a daily basis, because actually in Central America and South America, there's very difficult opportunities to dry plants. You have to take them to someplace, give them to them, take several days to dry them, and then usually you don't get them back again either. So it's not a good situation, and I felt that I could improve that. When I was in Madagascar, I tried this first with a makeshift dryer powered by two 3-burner cook stoves, little low stoves, and then I took the front seats of the truck out and I put propane cylinders in there, and they were connected to my stoves. And then I put the plant presses on top of the box, and the stove dried the plants from underneath.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, when the plants got nearly dry, they were kind of prone to catch on fire with the little sparks given off by the really dirty gas. Mm. So every now and then I would see smoke or smell smoke, and I got very paranoid because every time this fire took off, I had to reach in with my bare hands and pull this press out of there. Usually the strap was broken and burnt, and I ended up with just a whole bunch of plants in a pile, and I would take them out and get them in the sand to put out the fire, and then I had to put it all back together again and hope that it didn't catch a fire again.
So working in really primitive conditions.
Yes, with all these fires I had, I was convinced that it was a good idea to collect plants and dry them on the road, because it would have been impossible otherwise. Madagascar is a place where it takes 2 weeks just to get to the field, so you can't go back every day. So it worked out to be really nice. I collected 1,000 numbers in just the first week I was there. I collected 1,000 numbers. So it was very productive, whereas if I had been taking things back and forth, I would have gotten almost nothing done. But when I got back to St. Louis in the United States, I decided to build my own camper and dryer that would enable me to do the same thing, but in a safer manner. So I just took an old refrigerator, cut out part of the side of the refrigerator, took the door off, and that was built to sit on the side of the truck, on the bed of the truck. And then I put a three-quarter inch pipe in there, which I drilled holes in, and then I welded a Venturi tube onto the end and hooked that to a 100-pound propane cylinder. So it worked fine. And I put a big baffle on top so that the flame was not anywhere in contact with the dryer. And I set the dryer on about 125 degrees Fahrenheit, and my plants were mostly drying in a single 24-hour period. So each morning I would put plants in the dryer, take them out, put them in oil boxes, and store them in the truck.
Mm.
Eventually we'd have as many as 17 boxes, and we'd put them. I had a thing on the front of the truck where I stored all these boxes under a canvas. So we were able to really just work continuously collecting plants. It was quite efficient. I collected 5,000 numbers in 9 weeks' time, including shipping them, including shipping living material back to the United States. So it's quite efficient. I don't know whether this answered your question.
Well, it's very interesting putting out fires. I'm curious as to how many trucks you've used in your time.
Well, of course, in most cases, you can't use your own vehicle except in Central America, where you can actually get to by driving.
Hmm.
I can drive from St. Louis to Mexico in 2 days, and then going through Central America, because of all the border stops, might take about a week to get to Panama. It's only about 3,000 miles, but there's a lot of windy roads and a lot of border stops. And every time you get to the border, you can't necessarily get through because it has to be a certain hour of the day. So in most cases, the driving time is pretty serious. I haven't used trucks in South America except rental things. You have to rent a vehicle, and usually you can't afford a truck or even a Jeep. You have to rent just an ordinary sedan, like a Fiat, a little Fiat 4.
No.
Those are Renault. There's another nice Renault 4 and the Fiat. Those cars have little front-wheel drives. They have short wheelbase, and you can go over rocks, and you go into places where you can't. Or a Volkswagen Bug, another device. But today, they don't make decent cars for field work. They're all really low slung. You can't drive over a brick with them.
Yeah.
So they're not very useful in the field any longer. You have to get a different kind of vehicle. So it's increasingly more expensive to do field work because they no longer rent these little things that were cheap like a Fiat or a Volkswagen Bug or a Renault.
I've seen pictures of you living in huts and that type of accommodation. Has that improved or...?
Well, when you're living in a hut, it usually means you've gone a long way into a forest. You're living with some Indians.
Yeah.
In one case, I went up. They were creating a dam in Panama. They're damming up the Bayano River, and that dam was had a certain amount of water in it, and I had to get my way from the dam to the headwaters of the river so that I could go up the river to try to get into this big mountain range that's very isolated. And when I got in there, I first realized I had to climb up this waterfall, and it took me nearly all day. By the time I got to the top of the waterfall, there was a flat place, and I was walking along, and suddenly a young Indian jumped up out of the water with a spear, and I thought I was going to be speared.
Yeah.
He was actually looking for fish, and I startled him as much as he startled me. But it turns out that his family was living in that area, and I was dedicated to be there for a week, so I stayed with them, and unfortunately I couldn't continue on because it says it's going to take 2 days up and 2 days back, and then I made arrangements to meet the same guy, the chief, another time. But when I got there, he said, "Oh, it's rainy." He says, "Now it takes 4 days up and 4 days back."
Oh.
So I never got to the place. I just spent a lot of time living with these Indians in the headwaters of this river. I collected a lot of plants, but I never got to my objective, which was the summit of a chain of mountains that was ahead of me.
So difficult
who
to access.
Who needs holidays when you have adventures like that, hey?
You've nearly lost your life, though, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. It's a very... I mean, I thought as a farmer, which really is the most dangerous occupation in the world, more people are killed on farms than they are in mines. But I thought I was really getting into a very wussy profession, you know, botany, because it was not known to be dangerous. But I was quite surprised when you actually get into the process of collecting plants and going into remote areas, there can be all kinds of dangers, like drowning and being killed by terrorists, because Colombia is a country that would often capture somebody and hold them for ransom. I had a friend who was captured and taken away to a remote place, and they tied her to a tree. It was a woman. They tied her to a tree, and she eventually got loosed from the tree, and she tried to pretend that she was still tied up, and so she took it off running away, but then they caught her again. And it turned out that the people who caught her were actually not the same people who captured her. And they were people looking for her. She was able to escape because they knew where she had been. Mm. She was going to see somebody, and that person turned out to be a terrorist who lured her into the jungle, and then they were going to keep her for ransom because her father was not a rich man, but he had some money, and they were just going to try to ransom her.
That happened to you as well, though, didn't it? You were held, and they tried to ransom you.
Well, I was held for a different purpose. The guy thought I could actually help him. He was a kind of a crazed rancher, and he thought that I could get him a visa. I don't know what he had in his mind, but he kept me for a whole day. And it wasn't that he was locking me up or anything, but rather that I had no way of getting out of there because he had wound clear up into the mountain someplace. I had no idea where I was. So I just finally threatened him. I said, I'm going to go. And I started walking away. And then he said, okay, well, I'll give you some gas. Because I went there to get gasoline because I had run out of gas and out in the middle of nowhere because my gas line was broken and was leaking gas. So when I ended up in this little place where there was somebody selling some food, but there was two or three houses, but it was no town. And I was trying to get out of there. And this guy was an important individual who claimed to be important, at least. And he detained me for the entire day. It ruined my day because I couldn't collect any plants. And when I finally got back, I realized that the gas he put in the tank only got me back to the place where I was going. The next day, I was out of gas again.
Have you ever worried for your life? Have you ever thought this is it?
No, except when I maybe was hanging from a cliff or something. Mm. There were times when I...
Just little moments like that.
I was hanging from a cliff. And if the grass hadn't held, I would have slipped off. I got into a volcano where the volcano makes these big, deep ruts, and it's pure ash, and the ash is... almost like it's like sand. So I got in there by just jumping in, but then when I tried to get back out, it was exceedingly difficult because it was just slipping and sliding. I got to the point where we could just touch this grass, and I threw my collections aboard over on the cliff, and then I just made one lunge, and fortunately the cliff held, the grass held, and I was able to drag myself up onto the cliff. And at that time I was camped in this region. I think my wife was there at that time. Hmm. And I thought, well, what would she do? She'll never know where the heck I am.
You are. Yeah.
So, because I had wandered quite a distance. But so I was very happy to get back to the camper at just about dark.
Yeah.
My camper was often, it was felt like home because I lived in it for so many months that it was like arriving back home.
Yeah. That was your comfort.
Yeah, well, it was kind of comfort. I still have the truck.
Yeah.
50 years old.
I'm going to see that. That makes you emotional as well. Yeah. They could make a movie about you.
Perhaps.
They absolutely could. I'm thinking Netflix is real while you were talking, because I could just, a lot of the series that I watch almost touch on thoughts of things that you've talked about.
I think the other time I saw a tear in your eye was when Ray asked about what legacy you want to leave and you want to hand over to someone else. Do you think do you see anyone else picking up the baton?
There are young people who certainly have the skills, that is to say the exploratory skills, and some of them are very bright, but they're also usually in countries where they have little opportunity to get a job. I mean, they'd have to be able to immigrate or be hired because to work at the Missouri Botanical Gardens, they might be required to be an American citizen. Not necessarily. We have a lot of foreigner peoples working at the Missouri Botanical Gardens. So I'm hoping that somebody will be of the skill that would take up my role. And there are some, but they're largely Latin Americans, because in the United States, most of the students that are being trained in experimental sciences, like molecular biology. It's a very important tool because the gene has a lot more characteristics than you can find in an average leaf or stem. But these people spend their entire career in a laboratory, and they usually do not become good field botanists.
Yeah.
I'll give you a tip. We need more than one or two people to replace you, Tom.
Yeah. Well, it's true that you need a small army if we're going to save these plants before they go extinct. And this is the message I would like to get across, is that we've got to stop thinking that it's all done. And this is the problem. Everybody thinks, well, we know we have all the plants. Now they're sitting around making lists and making conjectures and studying things that that can be done 100 years from now. Even molecules can be studied a long time from now. They have DNA of the mammoth that's been extinct for thousands of years. So DNA studies could be made at a later time in our lives. But these plants that are vanishing in the field are not going to be around. You can't You can't study the ashes of a plant. They won't fossilize, so you're not going to have anything. The fossils that we have lived in the Cretaceous times when there were flooding and the whole plant was sunk and no oxygen, so they were conserved. But now when you burn them, it all just filters out into the ocean and there's nothing left. So it's a very serious matter in terms of the future of knowing what we had at a given period of time in the past.
And that's never been more critical
than now. We're a long way from that. I've collected in about 5,500 localities, and virtually none of those localities exist except a place like Barrow, Colorado Wildland, where it's a biological preserve and they guard it, and it's very difficult to even access. So that flora there will remain intact. But, even just because you're a national park doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be remaining there forever. Mm. Because I've seen parks where they're logging trees out of them.
Yeah.
And besides, if you took all the parks together, you wouldn't really make a whole lot of land. Most land is in private hands, and it's going to vanish as people cut it off and burn it. It's easier for an individual to get a permit to cut off 1,000 hectares of virgin forest to plant oil palms than it is for me to get a permit to take the twigs off of the stems, the plants that they're knocking to the ground. I can't get a permit to collect anything, even if it's in a fire. So it's the collecting permits situation needs to be improved. If they want to save these things, we have to be able to more easily acquire the opportunities to collect them. And at the present time, the obstacles are so enormous that most people don't even try. They either collect illegally or they don't collect at all.
Yeah, I hear you. Mm.
Do you have any idea how many thousands of specimens you have collected and identified over the years?
Well, my numbers are almost to 100. I'm just a little bit short of 109,000. And that means I've made 109,000 numbers, which means 109,000 different different collections, not necessarily 109,000 species.
Mm-hmm.
But since I collect in large quantities, I usually collect at least 3, sometimes as many as 5. And when it's new, I may collect 20 samples of the same plant because each one of those leaves is recognized as an isotype of the species, that is to say, a very important collection. And so perhaps a million total individual specimens were made.
Wow.
But the real difference between my collections and most others who have obtained more collections, there have been 3 people in history who have collected more plants than me. One of them, in fact, they claim 181,000, but I have never seen a single collection from this man, and presumably he collected only unicates or very, very little duplication, because if he had collected a lot of specimens, they would be scattered.
Hmm.
The other two collectors, Paul Stanley and Julian Steiermark, were both famous botanists who collected lots of plants. But I've seen their field books. They're little books like the one I've got in my hand, and you could put them in a shoebox. So they're not really very many. My collections are in great, massive books. They fill an entire shelf. And each one is 300 pages, and they're massive page sizes. So they're filled with notes, handwritten notes in abbreviated form, so that I can have somebody else read that chicken scratching and turn it into notes. The advantage to me is I can hurriedly describe the plants in the field, and the secretary or the girl that types labels reads my notes, and she turns it into nicely written English notes, which then go into Tropicos. So if you want to see a collection description of mine, you look in Tropicos under any given number, and the full description is in there.
Okay.
In early days, they would have been short, but more increasingly, I make larger descriptions because I know I'm dealing with undescribed species.
One of the ones that turned up in our local shops was one numbered 69686. And we thought, what a funny name. Like, why did it have a number and not a name?
Mm.
That plant confused me too, because I kept seeing references to it. People would communicate on WhatsApp and Facebook about the number. One day I thought, well, what's this? that number makes no sense. So I looked it up, and it was my own number that I had assigned to that particular thing. It was a hybrid that I had gotten from Betty Waterbury, who founded the International Aeroid Society. She had collected the plant in Brazil, and she said it was a hybrid that Burley Marx had created. Burley Marx is a famous landscape horticulturist. So I gave it a number, and I was growing it in the greenhouse, and it's still there. But I gave pieces of that plant to other people, and then, of course, once the thing is in the hands of one guy, eventually it's everywhere. Because plant people are very good at propagating and dispersing things, which is thankfully very good, because without propagating and distributing plants, they're going to be lost, because everybody loses something, and eventually nearly every species would be lost if it's just in a single collection.
Correct.
I try to emphasize this to my own administration, but they do not like to give things away. They do not like to exchange things unless you promise never to give it to somebody else. But what they should be doing is give it to somebody and say, please to duplicate it and send it to another person, because if not, you're not accomplishing anything. Just because it's in Missouri and at Kew doesn't mean it will survive. Mm-hmm. But if you put that into the hands of avid growers who really look at their plants every day and study every detail of them, those are the kind of people who are likely to keep it alive, because they'll find out there's something wrong with the medium, or the light, or the humidity. They'll learn to grow the thing. And if they didn't, if they gave it to somebody else, somebody along the line will keep it alive. So distributing plants in a prolific way is really the way to save plants, because once they're lost in the wild, we could at least say, well, we've got thousands of them in cultivation in North America,
what,
Europe.
What are your thoughts on hybridization of plants?
Well, hybridization is useful. It's useful to me because I know that if I cross one plant with another, it means they have some relationships. And if they do not cross, you after repeated attempts, you have to assume they're not related, or they would cross. Within Anthurium sections, there are 20 sections in the genus Anthurium. By the way, Anthurium is probably the largest genus in the world with, I suspect, 3,000 species. People will argue that this is not true, but I'm quite convinced that given time, I'll prove that it's the largest genus. The reason I know this is that the other genera that are large are not as widespread, and they're also more well-studied, whereas Anthurium is still very poorly studied. My explanations that I have mentioned to you of all these undescribed species that have to be in Colombia, that means that every place is rich in species, and that the genus will grow. We already got 2,000 names described, so I know that to get another 1,000 is not that difficult. Out of the 20 sections, only two of them have been revised, which means that the other sections will undoubtedly have lots more species than we think. I'm currently working on one group that has about 400 species alone, and I suspect that it may have as many as 500 species.
And what group is that?
That's Anthurium section Cardiolongium. It's a group that's very popular in Australia. Nearly everybody has lots of these because they're the ones that are velvety, and they look really pretty.
Yeah.
The velvety plants are velvety because of where they come from. They grow in the understory of the forest where there's high humidity and it's dark. And the velvet causes them to accept more light. When the sun shines on the surface of the canopy, only 1/100th of it will get to the ground where these plants are. So they have very dim light. And in order to survive, they have to capture every photon that hits them. And if you have a bubbly leaf or a velvety leaf, if you look at the surface under a microscope, what you're really looking at are little volcanoes. They're little beaks. And when the light strikes this thing, it bounces around. It is always captured. If it strikes a flat, slick surface, a coriaceous surface, half of it bounces off. And so the light doesn't penetrate the leaf at all. So you must have these soft leaves, soft tissue. And that particular genus, or that particular section, is really prevalent under these low light conditions. It also means they're pretty because the veils, the leaves are more luxurious.
Mm. Yeah, I love the black velvety anthuriums.
And they're usually, the blacker they are, they're usually the more light they need.
Is that so?
Now, what we were talking about in terms of pollination, those things in that section will usually cross with one another. And people in Australia have crossed lots of things.
Yes.
Now, the reason why you have to cross species here, because if you want something interesting, you've got to make it yourself
because
you can't get it in.
Correct. Yes.
You can't get the plants into the country.
So frustrating.
And it's frustrating because for a genus like Anthurium, there's no way that any Anthurium would survive anywhere in Australia in a great way. Certainly, Western Australia could accept every aerid that exists, and you probably wouldn't have a problem as long as you didn't get one of those little succulent things that grows like a, can survive in a furnace. Mm. Anthurium, you could bring every anthurium from the world here, and it would survive in a greenhouse, but would not survive anywhere else. It wouldn't get into a cornfield or a wheat field or ever escape, because they cannot survive outside of the womb,
more or less. Oh, 100%. Yeah. No.
So I would like to see the Australian plant nursery business and the government come to some kind of a realization that you're making things suffer. There's a lot of money in plants.
Yes.
It could be a good benefit to Australia if you had an opportunity to get things to sell. There's a big market. You're losing a dreadful amount of money for this very restrictive thing. Certain genera are hopelessly impossible to grow outside of a greenhouse.
Mm.
And as long as the government knew which genera would do this and avoid anything with the little tiny propagules like, Remisatia has little acorn-like things, little sandbur things, those actually could conceivably survive in a crack someplace, but most genera won't. And it would very much enrich in Australia's plant industry if they could bring things in without killing them, because they use methylbromine. They nearly kill it first. Then they don't give you any opportunity to do any curative possibility. They won't let you bring anything in to resurrect it to life. And only after they try to kill it and you can't do anything, you pray maybe one or two things survive. So it's a bad story.
And it's a very expensive process.
Very expensive, yeah.
The person trying to bring specimens in.
I feel so sorry for the poor guys that are trying to do this.
Oh, yeah.
Tom, I understand during your time in Australia, you've done a segment with Gardening Australia.
Mm. That's correct. It was my first day in Sydney when I arrived. I went to the Sydney Botanical Gardens in a special little room where they have a lot of sort of rare plants. I'm not...
The calyx? Oh, no, or somewhere more
it
rare.
It was a relatively large greenhouse, but still small by the other standards. And I think it was more or less designed to show off interesting plants, perhaps, because they didn't seem to have much in common except that they were interesting.
Was that open to the public, that area?
No. It's definitely not open to the public. I suspect that, for one thing, they had a lot of Amorphophallus titanium in there, which actually have a lot of cash value. So it may be that they had plants in there that were rare and therefore expensive, and they kept a locked key on the door. But anyway, it was an interesting little place to have an interview because you had things to talk about. And the gist of it is that we spent the entire day trying to create a storyline that they eventually will reduce down into a 7 or 8 minute segment.
Yes.
With a lot of pictures, a lot of pictures of different plants. And then our conversation with a young lady that was asking me questions. They had a cameraman, a audio man, a director, and an interviewer. So there's four people there, spent the whole day making this 8 minute segment. So it's presumably going to be good.
It'll be good.
I'm anxious to see it.
Congratulations, Tom. We don't have the right words to show our respect for you. I don't know how we encapsulate that, Fayakaro.
Well, we've done our best to give the listeners a little insight into our world, our love of aroids.
Yes.
And with one of the foremost
leading experts in the world.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for very kind words. And, of course, if people want to contact me and know more about me or
absolutely. How do they do
answer
that?
Questions, they can just email me. My My email is my name, Thomas, period, C-R-O-A-T, the little ampersand thing, and then mobot, M-O-B-O-T, .org, mobot.org. That's the email. By the way, you can also go onto the Missouri Botanical Gardens website. Just type in Missouri Botanical Garden, and it will bring up the website. Then you click on staff. You click on my name. You click on literature, and all of my literature that has been digitized, hundreds of different publications, you can download them for free. There's also PDFs of PowerPoint presentations that I've made without sound, but all the images are there. And there's also some YouTube videos of presentations that I've made where they've actually recorded the sound too. So sometimes these things are available. I remember I have something called an Indiana Jones lecture where I basically talked about the dangers of collecting plants.
Well, you are described as an Indiana Jones.
Well, that's sometimes what they say because I have been in a lot of scrapes, but they always called me accident prone, but in reality, I just didn't care. I didn't care about injury. I've been injured all my life.
You took risks.
Injuries are just part of the game, and if you don't take a chance, you won't collect the plant. You know,
I can see that you cut your finger off as well, didn't you?
If you don't climb, yes, that's another accident.
I know.
If you don't climb a tree, you won't get to the plant. So if you're careful, you can get up the tree. I used big long climbing irons with spikes, and you climbed up like a ladder, and you can move from tree to tree very easily. So it's a convenient way of getting into the tree.
we were very lucky to hear some of Tom's stories on the weekend at an Aroid Society meeting. And if listeners do want to learn more about aroids, there is an Aroid Society of Australia group online that you can join. And occasionally there'll be special features in Western Australia.
Tom, I know we've taken up a lot of your time this morning. Thank you so very much for sharing with us, and we wish you very safe travels back to the US, and wishing you a wonderful Christmas as well.
You
and your family. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. You're both lovely.
Thank you. Cheers for now.
Bye-bye.